It is 7:10 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with our producer Jonathan Lowe, and talking about hoping to connect with Maureen Bausch, the CEO of the Minnesota Super Bowl Host Committee. I do think that they did an amazing job. They had 10,000 volunteers. They put together an extraordinary effort, I think. I covered a few of the things, so I didn't really go to, you know, that many events, although I did find out a couple of days before the Super Bowl. I think it was the Thursday or Friday before. I had the credential to go to all the things like the NFL Experience or Super Bowl Experience, Super Bowl Live. They sent out an email at WCCO TV which said that, oh, the NFL accidentally sent us all or sent everybody in the WCCO newsroom Super Bowl credentials for the actual game. So I could have gone to the game, but they said, don't use them. And so I was half tempted to go and kind of sneak in there and take a look, but I didn't, because obviously that would have been inappropriate. And obviously we did have crews that were actually working there and actually doing the job there. But overall, I think things went really remarkably well, from the traffic coordination downtown. I don't know if people saw there were actually tanks downtown that were actually blocking off street corners when the traffic was passing. I actually went to the security command center, and that was amazing. I mean, it was, and I actually had to sign a non-disclosure agreement for 2 years not to reveal where that secret security center was in downtown Minneapolis. But I can tell you, it was so impressive, the whole effort. And certainly one of the reasons that this whole Super Bowl went so well is the Minnesota Super Bowl Host Committee, who I really think just did an amazing job. They were accessible. They were all over the place. They seemed to be literally in five places at once. And the CEO of that host committee, Maureen Bausch, is joining me now. Maureen, have you recovered yet?
Yes. I think we're back to normal.
You think you're back to normal? Well, have you gotten any sleep? Because I saw you the morning after, or the afternoon after, and you said you'd gotten a few hours. There was a big event with a handoff with the folks in Atlanta. But, you know, one of the people that works for you, Andrea, told me that it was very similar to running or working on a campaign, a political campaign, because it's nonstop, 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 and there's always something else you can do, and then it's over.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've not worked on a political campaign, but it makes a lot of sense. The difference is your campaign, your candidate won, but he or she is off to New York and leaves the staff behind.
Right.
So,
but you're still, I mean, you folks are still actually, there are loose ends to tie up, you know, bills still coming in. You're actually going to be on the job, I believe, until May, or some folks are, until May.
Yeah, until the end of May.
Okay.
The end of May, when you close down the office formally. But there are bills to pay. There's reports to be compiled. There's a lot of different details that have to be. And then we also will send quite a bit over to the History Center. We will compile a book for our partners, the great Minnesota corporations that paid for this. So,
yeah, and
there's some work to do.
Right. And I do think, you know, it went so well. We were talking with John Elder, who is with the City of Minneapolis Police Department, and he just talked the day after. He was just saying, we are just thrilled, but we are so relieved. From there, because they were in charge of the security, and they said, you know, that the attention to detail was so intense. And he actually told a story. I don't know if you've heard this, but I think it was the day before, within the perimeter, I think within a block or two of the stadium, there was a car that was just sitting there without any license plates. And they completely, have you heard this story?
Well, there's been a few things like
okay. That, yes, well, they were, of course, went into just, you know, complete professional mode. Mm-hmm. They got the Bloomington bomb squad. They got it all surrounded, and they set off a perimeter. And it was a tow truck driver who had a problem with his own battery and had gone to get and had to get another battery. And he comes back, and there's this major SWAT situation going on. But that's the kind of precaution that they took to make sure that everybody was so safe. And I think that that's something that I feel that you folks just handled that so well, and it was seamless. And there were actually fewer arrests during the Super Bowl period than there were this at this time last year. I mean, that's amazing.
Yes, it is. But it was 3 years of planning and many different organizations involved. As you know, there were rings. I'm sure you learned that. The rings of security, both police and then undercover and crowd control and National Guard and the training that went in, the tabletop drills, the practice, looking for anything suspicious. I think the city was so safe during the Super Bowl because of all the extra planning and people.
And you know, you folks were so, I think, smart, especially because of the way the weather turned out. Almost immediately, you went with this bold north, let's embrace the winter theme. Yeah. You know, was that ever a hesitation, or was that something you just thought off right off the bat? Because I think by doing that, I think you mitigated what might have been so, oh, this is so cold. I mean, I really do. I think that was just such a smart idea of yours.
Well, you can't hide February. It's going to do what it's going to do, right?
Yes.
And I remember being out in San Francisco and hearing someone, a fan who was attending that game, complaining about going to Minnesota in 2 years. And it was at that point I thought, you know, you really have to lean into this. And the Eric Dayton North movement had taken hold, and people were proud of being from the North. So it just kind of worked. Bold North took off, and it really was like, you know, don't talk to us about the cold. We know that. Now talk to us about all the great things Minnesota has to offer. And we heard so many positive things about how people were treated. I just am absolutely positively sure people will be back to Minnesota to visit.
Well, yeah, and you know, when I did a story with you on Monday, I used a bunch of interviews that my colleague and friend Angela Davis had gotten with fans leaving the stadium. And to a person, they talked about, I mean, every single one of the fans she interviewed, and she interviewed a lot, said people were so fabulous. The transportation, the logistics, getting to the stadium, all of those things were just so great. And they all said that. I mean, they literally all said that. So, you know, obviously you were able to pull that off in terms of getting people from Hotel A to, you know, or getting an Uber and all of that kind of thing.
It takes a lot of planning. It really doesn't happen by accident. And there were a lot of little touches along the way. And things, when you think about, when you strategize about an event like this, you want to think about the guest experience from the minute they start thinking about coming to your city to the minute they leave, and then you follow them through and what would make a difference. And we use that strategy. And so there were a lot of little touches along the way that I think helped seal the impression of Minnesota.
Right. And you certainly have a marketing background. You actually rose to the ranks at the Mall of America to become the top, you know, executive there. How did that help you as the person who was the CEO of this plan for this unbelievable event?
Well, they give you a book. The NFL gives you a book, and it's how to hook the Super Bowl. It's not terribly thick, but it's a good book. And
there's literally a book.
Well, it's a three-ring binder. It's a three-ring binder, but the very first line said, "We're going to give you a magnificent platform. Use it to talk about your city or your state." Because this is a wonderful opportunity. And of course, that is a directive to a marketer. And so it's just determining what you want the world to know about your state and then putting together a plan to tell them. And the Bold North worked within that plan, and our corporations made it easy because they are the innovative ones that we could talk about. So it worked, but that was the first line in the book. And so it's more than a football game. The capstone is the best football game of the year, but leading up to it is our opportunity to market. So it all worked.
Right. And you know, and I was involved with one event, you know, the Founders Breakfast for the Taste of the NFL that Dave Mona organized here, he did such a wonderful job because he was on that committee back in 1992. But some of those events, you know, what you just said, it's more than a football game. And it is so much more than a football game because, you know, of the NFL experience and the NFL Live. It was something that the entire community could embrace. And also the Taste of the NFL and the charitable events that went around. And it was sort of really cool as somebody who was actually reporting on it back in 92 to see all of those things that were innovations back then in 92 that started here in Minnesota be fully embraced to the umpteenth degree, you know, here in terms of the celebration that was Super Bowl 52. I mean, absolutely. That was really cool.
I mean, there were 28 nonprofit events that one week alone. I think you would need a month to go to every single event that happened in that 10 days. There were so many. We used well over 100 venues. There were private parties. There were public parties. There were gated or ticketed parties. But that Party with a Purpose really was launched here in Minnesota. And boy, has it taken off, as you said.
Right. The taste of the NFL. Was there anything that surprised you or that you had to kind of adjust as you look at, you know, looking back at it?
You know, I truly wish I could have made it to all 100+ events.
You were pretty good, Maureen. You were even on the zip line. You even did the zip line. I was like, I heard Jacob Fry was going to do the zip line. Some colleagues of mine did the zip line. I was like, there's no way. And then and Maureen Bausch was on the zip line. I was like, okay, she is everywhere.
Well, I was kind of coaxed into it by the CEO at Caribou. He challenged me, and I think he was right behind me. And I don't know that I would have gone if he wasn't pushing. But and then Chad Greenway, of course, was there with his GoPro, so I was stuck. I had to go. But it, you know, I did. I went in the back door of many things and looked around and had a glimpse and then went on. But there were some very organic, special places that kind of happened. And had we known about it, maybe we would have done it differently, or maybe we would just let it happen exactly the way it did. But Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and their 48 concerts that they did. We use that J.B. Hudson space inside Dayton's. It's kind of a place where the entertainers could gather, and we let people in to talk to them. It became this almost a club atmosphere, but a reunion of all these great musicians that came from Minnesota. And, you know, it just happened, and it happened every single night for 10 nights.
Very cool. And the concerts were amazing. And, you know, there were thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people here every night, despite the cold temperatures. And they were just rocking out. I mean, it was an amazing party.
The colder it got, the more people came out. And then when it snowed, I had 100 people tell me, isn't it perfect? Isn't it perfect? It's snowing. Now, the keyboards froze up, but the entertainer said, we'll just go in that green room and wait. Thaw them out. We'll come back. They were such troopers. They really were.
Wow.
But it was great fun, and people are not afraid of the cold here. They just aren't.
Right.
And it did get cold.
Right. And also, it sounds like the transportation piece worked out really well. At least, you know, and that certainly was verified by all those fans coming out. I mean, that must have taken just a whole separate layer of planning.
Yeah. And we have a great public transportation system here and a wonderful operating board that manages that. So to have community partners like the MTC and Met Council and all those folks, it was just wonderful because they all understood it. But if you had been to other Super Bowls, it does get crowded, and certainly with all those people in town, you are going to have traffic and pinch points and so on. But compared to other Super Bowls, it really, really was markedly less.
Right.
And that's probably what you were hearing from those people that have gone to 8 Super Bowls.
Right. And what about, and did the people from Atlanta, because you were part of kind of a cool, you know, it literally was a handoff that next morning. My goodness, you know, you folks didn't even get a break. It was, I think, at 8 o'clock in the morning or 7:30 in the morning. And there was Marilyn Carlson Nelson and you and, you know, Governor Dayton was there and officials from Atlanta. Was there anything that the Atlanta people had to say or were wondering about? Because it's a very, obviously a very different city, different climate.
Well, we've met with them several times in Miami and Tampa also. The next three are all southern cities. But every single week I would update Miami and Atlanta on what we were doing in real time. So they have all those documents. So it wasn't new news. They'll be back again within the next 30 days to debrief. Okay. And
oh, so you mean like 2 weeks out, you were saying, okay, we've just hired, we're setting up the perimeter around the, you know, so they were actually getting updates. This is what we're doing today.
Yeah.
And how many weeks out did you do that?
52.
You did it 52 weeks? For 52 weeks, you were briefing Atlanta. And so I know Atlanta has it next year and Miami has it the year after that.
Yeah.
So you were literally saying, okay, week 51, this is what we're doing this week here in the Twin Cities. Wow.
And it was just, I was doing it, I was writing it for a few other people, and I said, would this be helpful? And they said, yes. And so I would put in, oh, by the way, you might want to think of, and into those memos so that it helped. And every once in a while, I'd say, do you still want to get these? And they said, oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, I guess the Minnesota binder, three-ring binder, is a little bigger. Well, that's great. Well, I think you guys really did an amazing job, and I've just heard only positive things. I think people were a little worried about, you know, with that forecast, and, you know, really, I mean, yes, we're used to that kind of cold, but that's about as cold as it gets here.
And that's what I said. It's not going to get any worse.
Right. Well, that's awesome.
You all lived, didn't you?
Yes. Right. Well, I think people just had a great time. Well, Maureen, you guys have been so great to deal with from the media perspective. I mean, just really so accessible. And, you know, just congratulations. I mean, you really, really pulled it off, and an amazing job.
Thank you, Esme. You guys are great because it's a team. You guys, us, and the whole state of Minnesota. So I think we made a lot of friends, and that was the goal, right?
Absolutely. Well, it certainly, I think, made Minnesota look very, very good.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay,
have
take
a good
care.
Night.
Absolutely, Maureen.
Thanks.
Very good. That was Maureen Bausch. And, you know, I really, they were so smart, as I said, you know, in the interview with Maureen, just to embrace that bold north, because if they thought, well, maybe we can count on high 20s, which is what, in 92, I remember that. I remember doing stories leading up to the 92 Super Bowl, will the ice castle melt? And that was the big concern, because it was, you know, above freezing. And we didn't have that problem this time, but I do think that they did just an amazing job. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. You are listening to News Radio 830. Oh, hang on just a second. We are going to, I guess, take it to the bottom of the hour. I just thought that they did a really, really nice job. And I do think that even information about, I think information got out there. Like, for instance, I have a parking spot, and they said, you know, hey, anybody who has a parking lot in a city lot in Minneapolis and you want to park on Sunday, you won't be able to. Well, you know, I actually work on Sundays. And so I was like, but at least that information got out. I mean, I thought they were very good about that, very good about getting the information about all kinds of different events that were going on. I think they were also really good about getting information about events that were affordable out. I think the TV stations did do a good job, but they got us the right information. All of those things, I think, were just, they had daily updates for the media. I thought it was really, 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 really an amazing event. And I think, you know, we have, I guess, arguably the Final Four is, I mean, is that number two, would you say? Or in terms of, I mean, because that's going to get a lot of
neutral site event. That probably is number two on the annual
calendar.
That's
four teams, and they're here for, what, 4 or 5 days? And then I think there's similar events leading up to it, aren't there?
Yeah, it won't be it's not near as long as Super Bowl week, and I believe Sloan was talking about that in her newscast earlier this evening. They're not going to have to plan for 10 days of stuff. They're only going to have to plan for five. But still,
so it's only 5 days because you know, in the 92 Super Bowl, it wasn't 10 days. I'm not sure when that happened, but
it's grown over time. It's it probably really ratcheted up. I'd probably say 2000 to 2001, that time. Eric Nelson would know that.
Right. OK. Because I know it wasn't 10 days back in 92.
But the Final Four, it's much more condensed. It does. It's the NCAA. They don't have as much money as the NFL does. But you have, like you said, four teams. There are going to be two nights of actual gameplay. But there will be a night in between where there's really nothing that's going to happen as far as game action. And then they'll have a couple of days to have the teams. And the teams might get in here a little bit earlier than 5 days. They'll probably get in here maybe Tuesday or Wednesday of that week.
Right.
But as far as that's concerned, that might you may be right. That might be the second biggest sporting event
right.
that annually happens where it's a neutral site.
Right. Do you know – and because and I sort of remember the Final Four being here in 92, and it was here again –
2001.
Did they have – do you know if they have these events that people can take part in, like the Super Bowl Live,
yeah,
which was those concerts? That was free, and then the Super Bowl Experience, that was $35, but it's not – $2,000 or $3,000.
Right. I don't think you'll have something like a Super Bowl Live. I do believe they have something like an NFL Experience where you can go, you can look at different exhibits that will be up and maybe shoot baskets, or they'll have different games to play for kids and that sort of thing. I do think that will be somewhere in the Twin Cities. I don't think it'll be at the stadium, but it'll be somewhere.
Right. And well, they should, because people will pay money to go see it.
Oh, yeah.
So but I do think, you know, people love that event. They love that event so much.
And the good thing about that is it will be in April. It's
yes.
going to be in the beginning
yes.
of April. Now, the beginnings of April around here have been dicey. I can attest to that. Having lived here for the past 10 years, there have been some Aprils that have been extremely dicey weather-wise. But it's not going to be near as bitter cold
right.
as it was this for the Super Bowl, and especially in the middle of January.
Right. Well, and if it's dicey in April, it tends to be dicey for maybe a day, and then it gets
yeah,
better.
It,
or two
it,
days, and then
yeah,
it gets it, better. It's not this... We've had it for a while here, so
yeah. It's been the freezer has the light is still on in the freezer. We need to close.
It's coming.
The door on the
it's coming. 40s on Wednesday. I'll have a full forecast here in just a few minutes.
We need to walk out of the freezer and walk back into the kitchen.
Yes,
let's get into the kitchen in the room temperature. Let's try to do.
And
that,
I,
folks.
You know, something. I'd be happy with teens and 20s. That would be awesome. Perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect,
good,
perfect.
Good on you. Give me 60s.
Okay. I would love teens and 20s. That's perfect. Everybody can enjoy the snow, the winter sports, without just worrying about...
But I agree with you. I think... Now, I didn't get out and about as much
yeah.
as I would want to, but I thought the committee did a fantastic job. I thought they did a really good job of getting everything in those spaces where they needed to get the NFL Experience and the NFL Super Bowl Live, and using the Mall of America, using the XL Energy Center. I thought they did use their resources well. And unfortunately, when you get up here in January, the early portion of February, it's going to be cold. You can't really do anything about the weather.
Right. But Maureen Bausch was right. The concert crowd that night before the Super Bowl on Nickel and Mall, the colder it got, seemed more crowds came out, and maybe it's because they were here and they wanted to embrace it. But I thought that was really amazing.
I thought they did a very good job of again using their resources well, using now the depot or the armory,
right.
and using that as a venue. I thought they spread it around very well.
Right. Very cool. All right. Well, listen, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll give you some weather, and then later on, we're going to talk with a doctor from Abbott Northwestern about a new blood cancer test for different kinds of cancer. Really something that's very cutting edge. That's coming up on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8 degrees, 737 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with producer Jonathan Lowe. And at 8 o'clock, I do want to let you know that we will have my friend, after the news break, we will have my friend David Schultz to talk politics. And as always, there is a lot to talk about. But this half hour, we are going to talk about some new blood tests that really perhaps could be a breakthrough, or certainly a help in diagnosing and dealing with the battle against different forms of cancer. Dr. Michaela Shaw is from the Minnesota Oncology at Abbott Northwestern and is joining us now. And first of all, doctor, did I say your last name correctly?
It's Tsai.
Tsai.
That's okay.
Okay, my apologies.
No worries.
Dr. Tsai, tell us about these blood tests and what exactly, I mean, do they involve and what can they detect?
So this particular test is called CancerSeek, and this was from research done at Johns Hopkins, published recently in the journal Science, a well-known scientific journal. So this is looking at a combination of two different tests that we've been able to do individually in the past and a new computer algorithm to try to screen for cancers. So it's looking at protein biomarkers in combination with mutations in circulating tumor DNA to screen for eight different types of cancer.
Wow. Okay. What are the different types of cancers that, that are involved here?
So ovarian, liver, stomach, pancreas, esophagus, colon, lung, and breast. And what's particularly exciting about this test is it can, in theory, screen for cancers that we otherwise don't have good screening tests for, like ovarian, liver, and pancreas.
Right. And what were the ones that you left out there that it doesn't, the major ones that it won't test for?
Well, so it's not testing for, let's say, soft tissue sarcoma, endometrial cancer, melanoma, things like that. It's probably not as helpful testing for things that we can already screen for quite well, like breast cancer, cervical cancer, and colon cancer.
How about lung cancer?
So this test is screening for lung cancer.
Okay.
We have, you know, CT screening for people at very high risk of lung cancers, people with high smoking histories. But yes, lung was included in this particular
wow.
test.
Okay. And let me ask you, how does this differ? Because I know that there's some DNA testing out there for people who might be in a category of having certain types of breast cancer. How does this differ from it? Or is this a supplemental tool?
So you can do genetic testing to see if you have an inherited predisposition to breast cancer. For example, BRCA1 and BRCA2, and now a number of other new genes that you can be tested for if you have a very strong history, family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. But this is actually a blood test looking to see
if you have it.
Cancer.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that was a very good explanation. I think I understand exactly what you're talking about. It's like, the most famous example, I think, when people think about the genetic screening, at least for women, a lot of people remember Angelina Jolie, whose mother died of breast cancer at a very young age. And she was screened and she apparently did have the gene. She went public with her decision to have a double mastectomy. That's one thing. And even though she had that gene, if somebody has that gene and their mother died from very early age, it doesn't necessarily, they've got the gene, but it doesn't 100% guarantee that they will get it, does it?
No, it doesn't. So it means they're at markedly increased risk.
Right.
So, and depending on your gene mutation, that risk could be as high as 60% to 85%, but it's not 100% guarantee you're going to get the cancer.
Okay. But this actually can say if you do have it, is this, how early can this detect the cancer?
Yeah. So that's one problem with this test currently. So when they looked at their subjects, there's about 1,000 subjects in this study. It did a much better job diagnosing patients with stage 3 cancers. It was not as sensitive diagnosing patients with stage 1 or stage 2. And actually, breast cancer was where this test performed the most poorly. It really didn't screen well for early breast cancer.
Wow. Okay. And isn't that, as an oncologist, Dr. Tsai, isn't that, it's what you always hear, is that early detection is so important.
Right. So we can better treat and cure cancers if we catch them early, stage 1 or stage 2. I'm not as worried, though, about breast cancer because we already have pretty good screening tests for that, mammograms, ultrasound, MRIs. Where I think this would be most promising would be ovarian cancer and pancreas cancer, where we almost always catch these at stage 3 or stage 4 when we can treat them, but unfortunately can't cure most of those patients.
Wow. Okay. How widespread is the use of this? And because it sounds like a great diagnostic tool.
It does. And right now it remains investigational. So they looked at really just 1,000 patients. They're now going to extend it and look at a larger sample of patients. So I think it will be a few years yet before we're going to be able to implement this, you know, routinely in our clinics. But I think this holds great promise and more promise than similar tests that we've seen in recent years.
In terms of, Dr. Tsai, what are some of the advantages of getting this blood test? It sounds like you're saying it can detect cancers that perhaps people may not even realize they have.
Right, exactly. So let's say you go and you have this test and it suggests that you have colon cancer. Well, then you're going to go get your colonoscopy. We'll see if you do have colon cancer, and then that can be treated. Similarly for lung cancer, it suggests you have lung cancer. You go get a CT scan or a PET scan. Hopefully we've caught it stage one or stage two, when you can have an operation and be cured. And pancreas cancer especially, I mean, you don't feel pain in your pancreas until there's a big mass that's causing a big problem. And the mortality rate for pancreas cancer, you know, is nearly 100% at 3 years. So
really?
Finding pancreas cancer early would be, you know, extremely important.
Okay. And in terms of where do you see this headed? So that right now, this just in the experimental stages, it's being expanded. Is it available here?
Not that I'm aware of. There are other assays you can do, again, looking at biomarkers or circulating tumor cells, but not doing this particular CancerSEEK test. I think that other companies will probably try to recreate their work. So I imagine over the next few years, there will be more and more companies offering similar testing. But as of right now, I think unless you're part of a study, you probably can't get this CancerSEEK test.
Right. And there are folks, I mean, there are a number of studies out here, because I know people who have, you know, signed up for studies, you know, in the Twin Cities and at hospitals, right, you know, around the state. I mean, there are actual trials going on here. So, you know, you can look, and usually those are on websites and something that people do take, you know, can take advantage of. In terms of, you mentioned that, like, for instance, ovarian cancer, this could be, you know, really, because that's often detected so late. Is there, of the eight cancers, is there one where the detection has changed the most over the past, you know, decade or generation?
So I think the three where we've seen really the greatest advances are, of course, breast cancer, colon cancer, with the implementation of colonoscopy screening. And now there are other non-invasive ways to screen for colon cancer that have become, you know, promising for those who are wary to have a colonoscopy. And then lung cancer. I mean, it was not that long ago that we realized that smokers could have low-dose CT scans and find their lung cancers early. So those three, I think we've seen the greatest advances. Those where we still have the most progress to make are, for sure, liver cancer and pancreas cancer.
Right. And in terms of lung cancer, is this as effective in those who are not smokers? I mean, because they're, you know, I guess I'm always sort of struck by the cases of people who do get lung cancer who are not smokers.
Right. And we've seen more of that, you know, 10 to 20% of lung cancers now occur in never smokers.
Really? I didn't realize it was quite that high.
Yeah. And whether it's secondhand smoke, radon, other environmental exposures, we definitely see more lung cancer in non-smokers. So this particular test could be done regardless of smoking history.
Wow. Okay. You know, let me ask you just sort of about some of the treatment options, because I know, you know, from those people I know who have had to go through this, and also people I've talked to for news stories, sometimes the treatment, the chemo, that's almost worse than dealing with the actual cancer. The consequences in terms of your day-to-day ability to be yourself and to look the way you look and to feel good about yourself, that can be almost as difficult as the cancer itself. Are there some advances that you think are especially exciting when it comes to the treatment options?
Absolutely. We do have a saying that sometimes the treatment is worse than the disease, but we've made great advances in supportive care. So we have much better anti-nausea drugs than we used to have. That's really revolutionized a lot of chemotherapy for people.
And how long, when is that? Because, I mean, I have a, you know, my mother, the number of, I guess it was about 6 years ago, just, and she's elderly, and she had, you know, two different forms of lymphoma, a non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's, and the chemo was just, she couldn't eat, and you know, finally we just said this isn't worth it, and 6 years later she's still alive and doing okay, you know. So it was one of those things, but it was literally that was so debilitating for her. She just couldn't hold anything down, and she was just losing. I mean, she was just a stick, and we, you know, we all decided this isn't the way to go forward. And we all thought that there was going to be some kind of drastic consequence, but we decided, you know, we talked to the doctor. I said, "Listen, this is just not right." She was on board with it as well. And fortunately, we were very, very lucky. I don't know if that happens a lot, but how long has this anti-nausea treatment or medication been on the market?
So there's lots of different ones. Depends which one we're talking about. But, you know, we've rapidly incorporated use of something called EMEND that works quite well. I think the latest breakthrough, of course, is medicinal marijuana, which works quite well for chemotherapy-induced nausea and decreased appetite. And as far as Hodgkin's goes, we're rapidly working to get a drug approved that's much less toxic than our old standard treatment for Hodgkin's lymphoma, which could be very intense. So, you know, every year new drugs are coming. So I'm sorry your mom had that experience, but I'm really happy to hear that she's still doing
it. Yeah, it was. You know, someone who was in her 80s and it was her, you know, it wasn't just us, it just wasn't right at all. Yeah. But she was very, very slender to begin with. And for her to lose, you know, that much weight was just really untenable. And I'm sure that there are other people out there who have, you know, dealt with that. And it's a real problem. If somebody's not eating at
Absolutely.
All, it can be
Absolutely.
Just.
Yeah, you can't safely give them chemotherapy if they're dehydrated and malnourished and developing electrolyte abnormalities. So it's just, we can do more harm than good with treatment. You're right.
Right. But in terms of, you know, overall, those kinds of medications really are helping people in terms of cope with the chemo.
Absolutely. And we're also using more, you know, targeted and less toxic cancer treatment. So one example of that would be immunotherapy. So medications that stimulate the patient's immune system to have an anti-cancer effect. And those approaches have been very successful in many different cancer types and have proven to be much less toxic than our traditional chemotherapy drugs.
And Dr. Tsai, you mentioned also medical cannabis. You feel that that is very effective dealing with the nausea that can be associated and sometimes overwhelming for chemotherapy patients.
I do. You know, I am able to prescribe it, and I have done so. I can't say a lot, but probably a dozen or so times. And for those patients, it has proven to be helpful for nausea, for pain, and for appetite.
So you went through the screening and went through the process of getting certified for that?
I did.
Okay. Because I know, and the reason I ask, obviously Dr. Tsai is a very accomplished physician, but there's this other level for those of you who are listening. In order to prescribe this, you can't just be a medical doctor with, you know, all kinds of specialized levels of training. You've got to go through the training process for the state of Minnesota, and that's been a barrier. I mean, people who are your patients are lucky enough to have you because that's an option. But the fact that these doctors have to go through the training has been a problem for people having access to it. I mean, you probably didn't explain that very well, but. There are a lot of doctors who are not certified to actually prescribe it.
Right. I mean, there are many physicians who feel like they already have enough that they have to do, and that's just one more thing that, you know, they're just too busy to do it. I just felt, you know, being a cancer specialist, that it was really important to be able to do everything to help my patients get through their treatment better and more comfortably.
Well, that's great, because I have talked to, and it's been a while, and maybe I should revisit that, but I know that that's been one of the issues, especially when that law was first passed. Well, listen, Dr. Tsai, thank you so much. This is a really fascinating discussion, and it is fascinating to hear the medical cannabis part of it as well. We appreciate it, and that blood test certainly sounds exciting.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I hope it's something that we can offer patients here in Minnesota soon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Interesting conversation there. But yeah, the medical cannabis, and maybe I'll suggest that as part of the maybe a story for that we can look at perhaps next weekend to our producer for this show, David Josephson. One of the problems with the startup of the medical cannabis was that you had to, the doctors had to go through this kind of lengthy training program. And here you have somebody like Dr. Tsai, who obviously is eminently qualified. She's not going to be an oncologist at Abbott Northwestern Hospital if she wasn't, but she had to go through this additional thing. And so a lot of doctors around the state, even though they are eminently qualified and wonderful physicians, don't have that credential, so they can't prescribe it. So that means you've got to go and find a doctor who has that ability to prescribe it. And it's really been a problem, I think, for a lot of people trying to find somebody who is qualified or has gone through – they're qualified, but has gone through the certification process. All right, we're going to take a quick break. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 7:56, 8 degrees here. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. It's great to be back on News Radio 830 WCCO with studio coordinator Jonathan Lowe, I guess, who's in it for the whole ride, studio coordinator and producer Jonathan Lowe, who's here for the whole – good lucky you, all 3 hours of this show. I'm thrilled to be working with you. Again, but anyway, coming up in the next hour, it's always so much fun to talk to this guy because he's so smart. He has such great perspective, and he really has such enormous insights into what is going on in the world of politics. And certainly, Manic Monday, it's been pretty manic in the world of politics. David Schultz is next.